The Iowa Art Showcase is Iowa Public Radio's monthly performing arts program devoted to Iowa's not-for-profit arts and cultural organizations. I'm Jacqueline Hallblum. The Iowa art scene is revving up for September and early October. We'll head to Davenport for an insider's peek at the Quad City Symphony's new season. We'll persuade poet Bradford Tice to read from his award-winning collection called What the Night Numbered. We'll chat with child prodigy and world-renowned violinist Sarah Chang. We'll revel in Simpson's fall lineup showcasing two early English operas. And we'll get the inside scoop on how composer and artist-in-residence Tim Ferry III wrote his new work for piano and recorded environmental sounds for the Hartman Reserve Nature Center. That's all ahead on Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase. Thanks for joining us.
Eventually, what we would like to do is to grow this program and make it a year-round program, or even open it up to like a writer in residence and build that kind of a relationship. I think also it might even grow into where the artist in residence might be a guest presenter at a plein air event, for example. This is just really in its infancy, and as it gets more and more attention, it's building the connection between the different art entities in the Cedar Valley.
The Hartman Reserve Nature Center's development coordinator, Connie Swoboda. Connie was filling us in on the Hartman Reserve's unique artist-in-residence program. This summer, the Hartman Reserve's lucky winner was composer Tim Ferry III. Tim, a 2016 UNI music composition graduate, was chosen out of a large field of applicants. While wearing his artist-in-residence hat, Tim was inspired to collect environmental sounds that he recorded on site at Hartman. He then combined them with his own original piano compositions in a work he called the Woodland Suite. Tim had previously discovered while watching GoPro videos of professional extreme sports that the viewer relied on music to help guide them. Tim decided that the music served as an important aid to the involvement level of the participant, and that music, if done correctly, could also serve as an auditory version of the experience as well. Tim's environmental recordings of the Hartman Reserve Nature Center will mirror a person walking on the various Hartman Reserve trails. His Hartman Reserve natural sound, along with his piano music, will reflect the six Woodland Suite movements, three of which will be called Swampland, Prairie Grass, and Heads Up. Connie Swoboda gives us background on the Hartman Reserve Nature Center.
Hartman Reserve is what we like to call an urban oasis situated in between Cedar Falls and Waterloo. It's 340 acres of woodland and the interpretive building and a couple of lakes. We have some soft trails and then the Riverside Trail, and the paved bicycle trail goes through it as well. And we figured that between all the camps, events, and educational programming, that we have about 33,000 individual or unique visits per year.
Tell us about this special project that Tim is part of and how you came up with this idea, this artist in residence.
Well, our Hartman Artist in Residence program began in 2011, and they call it forest bathing now, where you can go into the woods and it lowers your blood pressure and it just increases your creativity. Well, we made a program out of that, and we call it our Artist in Residence program. Our very first artist was Doug Davis, and he was a painter. We've had a sculptor. And this year, we had another impressive line of applicants, and we were impressed with Tim. He likes the natural rhythms of the woods, and as a musician and a composer, I can see how that would be really important to him. You know, you can hear woodpeckers, and of course that might remind you of a woodblock instrument, and then you get the rhythm that is really particular to what are they communicating. You know, this is my turf. So Tim actually held two public programs in early July using these little instruments called boomwhackers that he would lead both kids and adults out into the woods, and they would listen, and that was the important part of it, is to listen and observe what they heard. And then they tried to replicate it back in the interpretive center. So it was quite an adventure. And so Tim, being a composer, he was thinking that he would combine recorded sounds. He's been out here wandering the trails and making all kinds of recordings. For example, the steps that you hear yourself make when you walk the trails, the chum, chum, chum. You know, that's a wonderful underrhythm. And then, of course, the birds and cicada are really ringing right now. So he's combining those sounds that he recorded and his composition of piano music to come up with what he calls the Woodland Suite. And that's going to be really exciting. When he came up with that idea, I thought that was grand, just beautiful. I mean, if I couldn't have asked of anything more from a composer. So he is going to debut this Woodland Suite at the Hearst Center for the Arts, and that's on September 22nd at 7 o'clock.
So you went out, Connie, with Tim to collect some of these sounds. What was that like?
Well, it was pretty interesting because it forced me to kind of really listen. You know, we're always busy doing our work here as staff, but then when he held the microphone up, I sort of heard some things I didn't hear before. Even if it was really in the background and wasn't really in your face pronounced, I could hear some of those things. I was really interested to hear what he wanted to record. I know that he was interested in maybe catching some croaking sounds, and of course the bird sounds, and then of course the pileated woodpeckers that we're really famous for around Hartman. I really wish that Tim was here today and he could have explained a little bit more about the progress that he is making on his Woodland Suite. Unfortunately, in the middle of July, he took a trip to Colorado for a family reunion and he fell and broke his jaw. So right now, his jaw is on the mend. He had to have surgery, and sometimes that includes wiring your jaw shut. So he is learning to live with liquid protein, and we wish him well, and it looks like he will be free of the wires before his performance, so that'll be a time for him to really give one of his great smiles.
The Hartman Reserve Nature Center's Development Coordinator, Connie Swoboda. Connie Swoboda served as a proxy today for the Hartman Reserve Nature Center's 2016 Artist-in-Residence, Tim Ferry III. Tim Ferry III's Woodland Suite for Environmental Sounds and Piano, with Tim performing at the keyboard, will have its world premiere in a free concert set at 7 p.m. on Thursday, September 22nd at the Hearst Center for the Arts in Cedar Falls. For more details, please call the Hearst Center at 319-273-8641. To learn more about the Hartman Reserve Nature Center and their Artist in Residence program, please go to thehartmanreserve.org. Just ahead, we'll delve into the historical events that inspired poet Bradford Tice's new book called What the Night Numbered. We'll listen to how Sarah Chang got started on the violin. We'll investigate two early English masks being presented at Simpson this fall. And we'll hear what musical gems maestro Mark Russell Smith is rolling out with the Quad City Symphony this season. You're listening to Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase. The Quad City Symphony is celebrating its 102nd season this year with a Joined by the River theme. Throughout their Masterwork series, the orchestra will explore famous rivers from around the world and will dive into the Mississippi for their first concert. Music director and conductor, Maestro Mark Russell Smith.
There's so much river music. Rivers, obviously, throughout time, and no matter where you are in the world, play such a vital role in society and how things have been, and it's true of art as well, not just graphic art, of course, through paintings and things, but also musically speaking. And so to kind of predicate a season around the river and have at least one river piece per Masterworks concert was my idea. And so we're doing the Elgar Cello Concerto, and so that's British. And so, well, what British river? Well, there's the Handel Water Music, where the musicians actually played literally on the Thames River. And so they're just, you know, example after example of great river music. And the idea has been incredibly popular.
Well, tell us about your first concert in the series.
Well, interestingly, the hardest river to portray in orchestral music is the Mississippi River, because there are certainly Mississippi River pieces, but not necessarily for orchestra, not necessarily quote-unquote classical music. And so Michael Dougherty, who's an Iowa native, wrote a piece for, of all solo instruments, the tuba. Carol Jantz is the principal tubist of the Philadelphia Orchestra, and this piece was commissioned for her. Our tubist will be the principal tuba player from the Minnesota Orchestra, Steve Campbell, who is an amazing, amazing player. The tuba, of course, is rarely a solo instrument, and so that in and of itself it has great interest, but just the singing quality that Dougherty brings and the whole Americana Mississippi thing, I mean, it's just a perfect way to open the season. Combining that, we have Beethoven's Eroica Symphony, which he dedicated to Napoleon with the best of intentions, and then Napoleon proved to be who he was, and so Beethoven famously erased with such vehemence that it ripped through the title page. Anyway, so we have kind of the anti-hero Napoleon, and then the quintessential anti-hero, Don Juan. And so Don Juan is this big swashbuckling opener, one of the great openers in orchestral literature, so a fantastic way to open the season. The Eroica, we have a Beethoven symphony every year, and so that's our opening concert.
Tell us about the November concert.
Masterworks 2, we are at last having Garrick Olson come visit. He was originally scheduled to play with us for our 100th anniversary season, but had to withdraw for health issues. And so he is an old friend of the orchestra, played in Iowa City a lot, played here a lot, and he was just very, very happy to be able to fulfill this obligation. And many in our audience remember him as a very young player and him growing up, and now here he is, one of the world's greatest pianists. And then we have a continuing Brahms concerto cycle. There are four concerti of Brahms, the violin concerto, the double concerto for violin and cello, and then two piano concerti. This is the final installment in that series, and who better to play the Brahms second piano concerto, because the orchestra has lots to do, the pianist has lots to do. It's just really one of the quintessential romantic concerti. And so he, of all people in the world, if I had a first choice to play the Brahms second concerto, it would be Garrick Olson. So he's coming back. Our river piece is the Moldau. Obviously, by Smetana, part of Mavlast, My Country, along with the Blue Danube, maybe the quintessential river piece. Tobias Picker also wrote a piece called Old and Lost Rivers, a very picturesque, almost movie music-esque, but very Americana sounding. And then more evocative music of Mendelssohn, Midsummer Night's Dream music, because this music is so magical and so descriptive, and Mendelssohn's music, especially this Midsummer Night's Dream, is just music of such genius and such character. And so with these other color pieces, with the Moldau, with the Tobias Picker, we have colorful music that actually doesn't have anything to do with the river, but what the heck.
And then your Handel outlook.
Right. Now we have a double river here. The opening we had single river and then two other pieces. Now on this third, we have Hannah Holman, our amazingly wonderful principal cellist, playing the Elgar Cello Concerto. And Hannah is one of the gems of Iowa musicians, lives in Iowa City and part-time also in New York, plays in the New York City Ballet Orchestra. For her to play the Elgar will be a unique experience. Our audiences love her, and they love Naha Greenholz too, our concertmaster, who will be featured in the next concert. The Elgar, that was the given. The second half is one of the ultimate river pieces, and that is the Rhenish Symphony of Robert Schumann. Schumann also is a composer underrepresented. The music, I think, is so deeply felt and so expressive, and especially this piece, the Rhenish, and all the heroic aspect of it, the mysterious aspect of it, the colorful aspect, the kind of Lendler, the kind of folky aspect of it. And so this symphony is a great romantic portrayal of that river in symphonic form. And so you couldn't obviously have a river season without doing the Rhenish Symphony, and just a great opportunity to discover music that isn't played enough.
Tell us about your February concert.
So Masterworks 4, we have our two wonderful principals, in this case the concertmaster Naha Greenholz, and we play Mozart every year just as we play Beethoven every year. And I asked Naha actually to do a violin concerto. These are works of genius that Mozart wrote for himself as a teenager, I mean 17, 18. And it just gives you a precursor, but in a kind of fresh, vibrant way. And so you have kind of young and sassy Mozart doing interesting things structurally and using the violin as a soloist voice in a way that hadn't really been done before. And so we see a genius taking form, and I love just the freshness and the vigor that the violin concerti have. I pair that with the Prague Symphony, Symphony No. 38, very late. Prague was a really important city for Mozart, where he had great success. He was almost more loved in Prague than he was in Vienna. And so he loved Prague, and Prague is one of the great river cities. The Moldau, the Vltava is there. There's the Charles Bridge. Prague is such a great city. And in addition to the Blue Danube Waltz, which is on this program, and the Mussorgsky Dawn on the Moscow River. So this is a really colorful program. We also commission a piece each year. And Michael Abels is, I think, the perfect composer to write a river piece, because his music is very descriptive, very colorful, very approachable, very rhythmically infused. And so the only thing that we asked Michael Abels was, it has to be somehow about river and or water in some way. And so to combine it with the tried and true, like the Blue Danube and Mozart Prague Symphony, and to have a world premiere is going to make for a very exciting evening.
So tell us about this next river journey you're going to be doing.
This is a big-boned program, if there ever was one. One has to include music from the Ring. Wagner understood that if it's going to have legs and have a bigger audience than just opera-goers, that he needed to make excerpts, and we needed to take sections, the fabulous orchestral interlude and sections of the Ring operas, and other operas too, frankly, and make concert versions of them. And so we have Dawn and Siegfried's Rhine Journey. Siegfried, of course, is the Überheld, you know, the superhero, who happens to play the French horn also, luckily. But the whole idea of the hero playing the horn and that kind of testosterone-driven, you know, with the sweeping water and actually a very beautiful sunrise. We have Dawn and the offstage horn calls and just all the drama that Siegfried shows us. We have Heidi Melton. She's now singing Sieglinde in Die Walküre in Bayreuth. They had a cancellation, and she was asked to sing, so that's a really huge deal. And so basically I said, Heidi, you can sing whatever you want. What do you want to sing? And Strauss' Four Last Songs, among the last pieces that Strauss wrote, looking back wistfully, this is post-World War II, and poignant and expressive and among the most beautiful things ever written. And then, of course, she needs to do some Wagner as well. And Wagner himself paired the Prelude and the Liebestod, like the alpha and the omega of this six-hour opera. And so the Vorspiel is just us. The overture is just us. And then she comes in and sings. Love Death is what it's called. And so she drinks the potion and sings about love. And the opera comes to a tragic and the inevitable conclusion. So we have Prelude and we have Love Death. So it'll be a great evening. And if that weren't enough, to close with Daphnis and Chloe, Suite No. 2, it just is something very different that we don't have in the whole rest of the season.
Talking about a big concert, tell us about the last one of your season.
So we've had our river season, and you could push a point and say the St. Matthew Passion is about rivers of tears. And people have tried to say, well, how does this have to do with the river, except there's a river in Leipzig where Bach wrote it. It doesn't have anything to do with the river. To say it's one of the most important works of Western art is not an overstatement. It's not just another night at the symphony, and it's not just another night for the players, for the singers, and certainly not for the audience as well. However, you'll come out of it a changed person.
Do you know who the soloists are going to be for that yet?
Dan Coakwell will be the evangelist. Dan Lichty will be Jesus. The soprano is the soprano with whom I worked in Germany, who's actually Scottish. Adriana Zabala is the mezzo. Will Ferguson is the tenor. It will be a very, very special time.
The music director and conductor of the Quad City Symphony, Maestro Mark Russell Smith. Soprano Corrine Tinney and bass Paul Max Tipton will also be vocal soloists on the Quad City Symphony's April 8th and 9th of 2017 St. Matthew Passion Concerts. The orchestra season boasts a five-concert signature chamber series that is spearheaded by the Quad City Symphony's concertmaster, Naha Greenholz. Plus, they also have a three-part pop series that includes a riverfront outdoor performance, a community holiday show, and a family concert. Don't go away. We'll marvel at Sarah Chang's activities off the concert stage. We'll hear about an early music ensemble joining forces with Simpsons Opera Productions for this fall. And we'll see how Psyche and Cupid play a vital role in Bradford Tice's new poetry collection called What the Night Numbered. You're listening to Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Arts Showcase.
Of different things. There are universal thoughts in general. It's very easy to be fair and don't kill nobody and da da da, you know, those things. A lot of things happened in the 60s. A lot of people stood in the 60s. A lot of people went down in the 60s for standing. That's unfair. Stand.
I took a lot of inspiration from David Carter's book Stonewall, the riots that sparked the gay revolution, and I fell in love with the story of these people. And I think that when we study history, we sometimes lose looking at the faces of the individuals who participated in the shaping of history. And I think that was what was really great about David Carter's book. It sort of put those faces back on that history for me. So I think just the discovery of these lives and what they sort of went through and how difficult it would have been at this time, given the climate toward gay and lesbian individuals kind of pre-Stonewall, how difficult it would have been for the first time, like sort of standing up to their own victimization and saying, we're not going to take this anymore. And I think that there's something kind of lovely in that. And that's, I think that's why I sort of decided that the narrative of Cupid and Psyche was so apt in the end, that, like, you know, in the end is a story about love, and in the end the story about the Stonewall Riots is also a kind of act of love, a very brutal one in some ways, a very violent one, but sometimes, as the grandmother in one of the initial poems in the collection says, sometimes, you know, fire is fallow, sometimes you have to burn the seed to make it grow, that from this sort of act of destructiveness can come something beautiful and something lasting in a sense. So it really sort of exposed some of those kind of holes in our historical narratives where we see silences that sometimes take place within the kind of larger cultural narratives that we have. And this book, because I felt like the story of the Stonewall Riots and a lot of gay history had been sort of silenced, had been whitewashed from the history books. So part of writing the book was, you know, I need to get this story out there. More people need to know about it.
Dr. Bradford Tice, poet and associate professor of English at Nebraska Wesleyan. Dr. Tice is an extremely talented poet whose work has been featured in the Atlantic Monthly, North American Review, The American Scholar, Alaska Quarterly Review, Mississippi Review, Crab Orchard Review, as well as in the Best American Short Stories 2008. This year's fall, an online issue of the North American Review will feature one of Dr. Tice's new poems. His appearance early next month at UNI will be in celebration and awareness of LGBT month. He'll be reading from his most recent book, What the Night Numbered, a collection that intertwines classical mythology with the events surrounding the Stonewall Riots. Dr. Tice talks about how his career evolved.
I really didn't get my start until I took a kind of introduction to creative writing class as an undergraduate at the University of Tennessee. And I had a fantastic professor named Deborah Scaproth, and it was her class that sort of sent me down that path.
You have a novel in progress, and you've had a whole bunch of poetry and fiction in different publications. Tell us about some of the publications that you have articles of poetry and fiction in.
With fiction, I published a number of years ago a short story called Missionaries in the Atlantic Monthly, which was later picked up by Salman Rushdie for the Best American Short Stories 2009. And we're currently at work on a novel, which I guess the simplest way to describe it is sort of a take on the Southern Gothic. And I've published two collections of poetry, One Rare Earth, which was published with New Rivers Press, and What the Night Numbered, which was published by Trio House Press. And currently at work on another, you know, poetry manuscript as well, so I try to keep myself busy.
You are coming to the University of Northern Iowa to give a reading. Tell us how you got the idea for this book.
So this book is sort of, I call it novella in verse, and it sort of simultaneously tells two sets of stories. The first is the myth of Cupid and Psyche. As I was growing up, my favorite myth had always been the story of Cupid and Psyche, this sort of love story, in which like this sort of rapscallion god of love is sort of tamed through the sort of socializing institution of marriage. And I always loved that story. And at the same time, when I was kicking around that idea for a project, I was also kicking around the idea of doing something about the Stonewall Riots of 1969, which, if you don't know, is a series of riots that took place in Greenwich Village, New York, in 1969. And they are kind of credited for having jump-started the gay and lesbian civil rights movement. So I had these two projects that I was thinking about, and I think at some point, I don't really know what it was. I think it's just at a certain point I had been thinking about them so much, and eventually they just became the same project. So then the book became a sort of retelling of the story of Cupid and Psyche within this historical moment of Greenwich Village, New York, shortly before and then during the Stonewall Riots.
You also take the Stonewall Girls, which was a song that kind of went along with this cycle of events that happened. So tell us how you weave this in along with Cupid and Psyche.
I have to give credit to David Carter, whose book Stonewall was kind of like, you know, a key piece of research that I used when creating collection. And one of the things that I discovered was, I guess I had pictured in my mind who the participants in that riot would be, and this sort of exposes my own prejudices, perhaps. I had in my mind that they would be sort of intellectuals coming out of universities, but in a lot of ways they weren't. They were these street kids who had come to New York, oftentimes because they were escaping abusive families. They were oftentimes kids at very young ages who were simply too, quote-unquote, queer or too sissy to kind of pass, you know, within the larger culture. So they were often kind of escaping very, like, you know, turbulent families, and they would come to New York City, which was at that time one of the great cities where you can kind of disappear in this kind of anonymity that New York sometimes offers. But when they came to New York, they often sort of, since they didn't have many means, they would end up on the streets, and they formed these kind of gangs or sort of pseudo-families. And I found that really fascinating because, one, it sort of shows like one of the gay and lesbian strategies for survival throughout our history of sort of banding together and sort of forming these alternative families when our sort of biological families sort of fail us in some ways. And also, I thought it was so sort of poetic in a way that people who participated in this riot were these street kids who they rioted more so than anything else because they had nowhere else to go. They had nothing left to lose. And these were sort of like, you know, the very sort of the outcast of society. So I really sort of wanted to tell their stories once I sort of discovered this because it seems so kind of wonderful sort of movement, which really sort of spurred the gay and lesbian civil rights movements from its infancy, was started in some ways by the very people that, unfortunately, that the gay and lesbian movements at times has kind of left behind, these sort of individuals who are sort of outside of our normal ideas of what it means to be masculine or feminine or straight and gay, and et cetera, et cetera. But I sort of loved that, and I sort of used that as kind of an inspiration for the characters in the book. In some ways, I thought of the character of Psyche, who appears throughout a number of these poems, as a kind of a sort of transgendered youth who was transgendered at a time before there was kind of even a word for that identity. So you see her as a kind of character constantly morphing and trying to sort of find a place, a sort of name for herself in a culture that doesn't really have any names for someone like her except for slurs at this time.
And you also put in the voices of the police officers in conjunction with the voices of the people who were at the Stonewall Club. Tell us how you juxtapose those and try to bring them together.
Yeah, I think the character of Psyche in the book represents those kind of street kids, the Stonewall Girls, who, you know, form that kind of alternative family. And then on the other side of that was sort of, you know, persona of Cupid, who throughout the book keeps kind of shifting and warping in his persona. In one of the poems, it comes out that Cupid is the name that Psyche gives all of her Johns. So all the Cupid poems are sort of different faces of different Johns, different kind of individuals that Psyche has either loved or lusted after in some way or another. So in a way, like a lot of the Cupid poems are kind of very problematic. The personas are often like people who are not the best people. They're homophobes, they're blackmailers, they're the institutionalized. I sort of did that to sort of show these sort of other faces of love and desire. I think like one of the most difficult ones to write was the poem Cupid in Sheep's Clothing, which is the poem where the persona is that of an undercover police officer right before the police raid the Stonewall Inn, which was the gay bar that was raided on the night of the Stonewall riots. And I wanted to write that poem because I felt like that I really needed to kind of try myself to understand like where the hate for gay and lesbian individuals might be stemming from. Could I do that? Could I sort of put myself into a position of someone who is very much against this community and try to understand in a really psychological and human way like where that sort of hatred and where that sort of bias and bigotry is coming from? And I felt like I had to do that as a kind of counterpoint to the larger narrative, which was the really revolutionary act of these young street kids who, having come from nothing for the first time, sort of stand up for themselves and say, no, we're here and we matter. So yeah, so I felt like, you know, that balance had to happen. The Cupid poems kind of allowed me to explore some of those counterpoints to that kind of larger narrative of these street kids kind of rising up in this historical moment.
Please read a couple of poems from your book. That would be really nice if you would do that.
Sure, absolutely. I would love to. The two poems I was going to read were two of the Psyche poems, so they're from Psyche's perspective. This first one is called Psyche Returns from the Underworld. And just to give you some background on where this is in the collection, this poem takes place after Psyche and one of her friends are beaten by the police during a raid of a kind of cruising area within New York City. And her friend, who's kind of left behind during this kind of moment, is severely beaten and ends up in the hospital. And since then, Psyche's been kind of like hiding out in her apartment and not wanting to go out. So this poem, you know, sort of takes place at the moment where things sort of change for her. And this is called Psyche Returns from the Underworld. Yesterday, I sat on the fire escape, watching the black kids in the building across the way take a wrench to the hydrant on the corner. One kid would yell, ho, and they'd jump, putting all their weight onto the handle, loosening inch by inch the bolt. Once it gave, I swear it shot like a penny from a gun. The kids began this shimmy in and out of the spray, breaking it around their shoulders, their hair soaking it up till every fro nested jewels. They laughed as if they discovered some new rite, not meant for the gods but for men, joyous and exalted. Unbidden, they brought their lips close and drank. I left the apartment then, went down to the street. The sun hurt my eyes, it was so bright. I don't know if I can describe it, how when I touched the wet concrete, the taste there was the city, huge and noisy, my city. A girl playing hopscotch through the spray stopped when she saw me, my fingers still resting on my tongue. Are you a boy or a girl? She asked. Honey, I said, touching her face. I am both. So this next poem I was going to read, again, is from Psyche's point of view, and this takes place during the riots themselves. So it's kind of the moment where Psyche incites the riot. So it is entitled, Psyche Incites a Riot. This I brought upon myself. All of us, newly returned from the edge of the underworld, the body going under, but not the voice. You know the story. The flags of Fire Island hung at half-mast. When the swine came, their boots blackened, buckles spit-shined until they flared under the naked bulbs. It was us that were corralled. No cowboys with their silver guns, angel hands, were there to keep the peace. Zazu, as she is handcuffed and led away, sings Hello Bluebird, and the girls with their manhood tucked and taped mouth the echo. We are constituted by an absence of voice, a lust for tenor. Grief is the thickest of greases, and what it covers is clay and steel, graffiti, a faint penny taste in our mouths. We have bitten our tongues like raw mothers. We have birthed ourselves, hemmed by everything we have borne. The veils have been pulled from our faces, and we are using them as shields.
Poet Bradford Tice reading his poem Psyche Incites a Riot from part 4 of his What the Night Number collection. He continues with his Shrine of Human Faces poem.
So to preface this poem just a bit, when I got to the end of the book, I really wanted Cupid and Psyche, their story, to kind of end in a marriage because that was in keeping with the myth and it seemed to make sense for me. But I couldn't write that narrative. I tried again and again to write this sort of marriage poem in which Cupid and Psyche are brought back together in the end. And I think I realized that in the end, since Cupid had been sort of a problematic figure throughout the collection, I just didn't think he was good enough for my girl, Psyche. In the end, I decided that her response to him would be a no, that, like, you know, in the end, what she was after was something more than what Cupid could offer. This poem I'm going to read, Shrine of Human Faces, is sort of her response to Cupid's final kind of invitation to love, if you will. So, Shrine of Human Faces. At first, I imagined you searching as I was searching. Imagined us passing in the crossing of two streets, your shoulder brushing mine. Me looking off into the high branches of the park toward some future I imagined had us pinned to a tableau of stars. Whoever said those suns were anything more than beautiful burning rubbish?
Poet and associate professor of English at Nebraska Wesleyan, Dr. Bradford Tice. Dr. Tice will be appearing at 7:30 p.m. in Bartlett Hall's Faculty Exchange Room 1017 on the UNI campus in Cedar Falls. His Thursday, October 6th, free and open to the public appearance will be in celebration and awareness of LGBT History Month. He'll be reading from his most recent collection of poetry, What the Night Numbered. For more information about Dr. Tice and his October 6th UNI reading, please go to uni.edu/langlit or northamericanreview.org. Just ahead, we'll check out Simpson's fall opera Double Bill, and we'll hear how one of the world's most famous violinists, Sarah Chang, selected her violin. You're listening to Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Arts Showcase. The Civic Music Association of Des Moines has been bringing world-class jazz and classical musicians to Iowa for 91 years. Their 2016-17 season kicks off on Saturday, October 1st, with the astounding internationally acclaimed violinist Sarah Chang, along with Julio Elizalde at the keyboard. Miss Chang began playing the violin at 4 and was admitted into Juilliard by the age of 6. Sarah Chang.
And I studied with Dorothy DeLay, who was probably, you know, one of the most foremost teachers while she was alive. And, you know, she was the best kind of teacher that I could have ever hoped for. She was very gentle and very much like everybody's grandmother. And, you know, we would talk to her about everything, not just music, but about our lives and boyfriends and friends and our parents and anything we would ever want to complain about. We would all go to Miss DeLay. So she was like our teacher, our coach, our sort of life advisor, you know, all of the above. And, you know, with me, because I was such a child, I was such a little kid that, you know, she really did take on almost a grandmotherly role. And she was tough when she needed to be, but she was always very gentle and very encouraging, and it really was the best sort of environment to grow up in.
And you started out and made your New York Philharmonic debut when you were just like 9 years old, and your first album when you were 10.
I was actually 8 when I made my New York Phil debut. That is really what kicked off my career, and everything sort of snowballed from there, because from that big debut concert, I signed with management, I signed with my record label, we made my first recording the next year. My career, really, at that point, just took off. You know, Maestro Mehta really is the one who really gave me my first chance, so I will forever, ever be incredibly grateful to him.
And you've gone on to win one of the top 20 female leaders in the nation, if not the world, by Newsweek. And you also got to carry the Olympic torch in New York City. You've really done a wide variety of things.
I feel very, very honored. Music is what I live for, and it's my life. It's not just what I do on stage, but it is part of my daily life. And it's really fun, though, when, you know, you get to do things that aren't musical, like running with the Olympic torch and going to Hollywood and receiving like the Wall of Fame Award, and then things like that. Those are just cool, just so much fun. And one thing that I am very, very proud of is the work that I do in partnership with the U.S. Embassy. They very kindly made me an artistic ambassador several years ago, and we focus on physical education for kids. They sent me to places like Bosnia and Ukraine, Kiev and South Africa and Buenos Aires and just all over the world to work with kids. And it's one thing to go on stage and to put on a glamorous gown and play in the world's most beautiful halls with the greatest musicians, but there is something that is deeply touching and satisfying and rewarding about working with kids in remote villages that I would otherwise never get to go to. And just to see their eyes sort of open and their ears open up when they hear the violin for the first time. And it is such a beautiful thing, and I feel so incredibly honored to be a part of that. And every one of us on stage who are fortunate enough to have any sort of platform, I think it's our responsibility to do something good with it. And for me, I love kids and I love performing. Those are the two things that I absolutely adore. So the program just seemed to fit perfectly because I get to play and also go and meet and work with children around the world and really get to see the different cultures and different backgrounds. And it really is a truly eye-opening experience.
Tell us about your violin.
My violin is a Guarneri del Gesù. It was made in 1717, so it is just under 300 years old. It is an incredible instrument, and I got it through Isaac Stern before he passed away. So it is an amazing instrument. I'm very, very lucky to have it and get to play on it every day.
Did he bequeath this to you, or he wanted to make sure it was sold to you, or you had it in your possession?
He was actually one of my teachers and coaches and mentors, and I was a small kid, and I was using all these small violins, a half size, a three-quarter size, and I wasn't big enough to use a full-size violin at that age. And then when I finally turned 14 or 15, my hands were finally big enough to play a full-size instrument. So Mr. Stern very kindly called up all these violin dealers around the world, and overnight he had all these Stradivariuses and Guarnerias flown in. And we went to Carnegie Hall because he basically ran Carnegie Hall at that time. And right before we went to try out the violins, he went into his safe. He had this amazing, amazing safe in his New York place where it was essentially the size of a big walk-in closet. And it was fireproof, waterproof, lifeproof. It was everything proof. And he had all of his instruments there. And he took out one Guarneri from that collection, saying that he thought it would suit my personality very well. And he wouldn't show it to me right there. But when we went to Carnegie, he mixed up all the violins and he asked me to play every single one of them. And I absolutely fell in love with this particular Guarneri. And it just so happened that it was the one that he had chosen from his safe. And he knew me well. You know, he knew my sound. He knew my bow technique. He knew what I wanted and needed in a violin. And that's when we worked out a deal. And I am very, very lucky to have this violin in my hands and own it and really be able to call it my own. And for me, it's also, there's a personal sentimental connection because he was my teacher. And I feel like there's a little bit of him in there as well.
That's a marvelous, marvelous story. Thank you so much for sharing it. You also mentioned relationships with folks. Tell us about the pianist that you're bringing with you to Des Moines.
Oh, so Julio is a fantastic, fantastic pianist. He is a wonderful duo partner, and he actually went to Juilliard as well. So we went to the same school. We didn't really hang out because we weren't there during the same years, but as a lot of people who go to Juilliard will say, it is a small, tight circle, and he's a fantastic musical partner, and we have a lot of fun on stage. It's really wonderful when you get to tour with the friend because you end up spending a lot of time with them on stage, of course, for rehearsals and concerts, but also off stage because you're traveling together and you're going out to meals together. And in our case, we have a really nice balance because I love to shop. He doesn't necessarily, but he's a big foodie and he loves restaurants and food, and so do I. And we look at our schedules and we look at the tour dates and the countries and the cities, and then we always look up restaurants that we want to go to. And it's a lot of fun to be touring with a friend.
Tell us about this program and a little bit about the pieces you'll be performing.
It's a huge program, but every single piece on the program is something that I absolutely love. So we're starting with the Bartok Romanian dances, which is an incredible opening piece. Lots of energy, you know, very, very intricate rhythms. And What's wonderful about the Bartok is that it is an energetic firework of a piece. It has amazing melodies, and as the title says, you know, it's the Bartok Romanian folk dances, and they're incredibly infectious and very, very rhythmical. And what I love about the piece is that you really get a workout, but it's not long. So it's great as an opener, because when you think of the logistics of a recital, you want a good opener, but also think of the late theaters. It's a really amazing, amazing piece. And Brahms Sonata, which is probably one of my favorite sonatas of all time. And Brahms is my hands-down favorite composer. You know, I love his violin concertos, his piano concertos, his symphonies. Like, Brahms is my top favorite composer. There's something about him that just goes straight to the heart. And we're doing the third sonata in D. I mean, that's one of my favorite pieces. And the Franck is a phenomenal, phenomenal piece. The Franck Sonata was actually written for Eugene Izai, who was one of the premier violinists of his time, as a wedding gift. And it's this amazing emotional journey if you go through the first moment all the way to the fourth moment, because it starts off with almost following a person's life through the infancy, and then the second moment is the sort of teenage turbulent sort of really roller coaster years, and then the third settles down a little bit when people mature a tiny bit, and then the fourth is the final chapter of everyone's life. And it is such a beautiful full circle of a piece, and I'm so happy with this program, and I'm delighted to be playing it in Des Moines.
Internationally acclaimed violinist Sarah Chang. Miss Chang, along with the amazing pianist Julio Elizalde, will perform as the opening concert on Friday, October 1st, in the Civic Music Association's 2016-17 season. The concert doors open at 6:30 p.m. in Drake University's Chesil Auditorium. The pre-concert program starts at 7, with the concert starting at 7:30. For more details about Miss Chang and Julio Elizalde's October 1st recital, please consult civicmusic.org. Just ahead, the Brits are coming, the Brits are coming. To Simpson College, that is. You're listening to Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Arts Showcase. Every year, Simpson College Opera presents two full productions. Their 2017 spring presentation will be Hansel and Gretel. This fall, Simpson students, along with a select band of early music players, will lower the drawbridge on landmark works by John Blow and Henry Purcell. Assistant Professor of Music, Larson Chair of Opera, Dewey and Larson Chair in Opera at Simpson College, and music coach Dr. Bernard McDonald fills us in on this fall's double bill.
We came up with Purcell's Dido and Aeneas, which was, of course, composed for young singers for a girls' school in London. And it's a one-act with fabulous chorus work. It's a very standard piece in a way to do for students. And it stands very well on its own. I thought we needed a little more. There are lots of opportunities in Dido, but what could we pair it with that would expand opportunity and give us a full evening's entertainment? And we turned to Purcell's teacher, John Blow, and his Venus and Adonis. So the pieces are related in that there's the teacher-student relationship between the composers. There's also the fact that they're kind of stylistically related, and they're both the earliest English operas, if indeed you would call them an opera. They have certain commonalities. Their structure is always something to French Baroque opera. So you have the use of big choruses and dance, and those were the hallmarks of the operas of Lully and Rameau, of course. So we have this interesting fusion of English Restoration era theatre, and of course with French opera and ballet. So together, the pieces are a fantastic opportunity for a large body of students to be exposed to the beginnings of an English operatic tradition. And we're very, very excited about performing it.
So tell us a little bit more about John Blow and his influences in opera or early masks or whatever.
John Blow was Purcell's teacher, and Blow himself recognised that Purcell was a prodigiously talented young musician, and he actually ceded his position as organist of Westminster Abbey to Purcell, and Purcell held that position until his death, whereupon John Blow took his old post up again. And Blow did not write very much music for the stage. There were some music for plays and some songs, but his true passion was church music. So I think musical posterity would remember Blow more for his church anthems and those kinds of things in the Anglican tradition. However, it's rather surprising that he didn't write more works for the stage, given the quality of Venus and Adonis. And this is a truly beautiful piece that is, of course, derived from the Greek myth. It's through composed in a way that makes it seem rather modern on the one hand, and on the other hand does make it seem like a Baroque opera. Now, I know that sounds like a contradiction in terms, but many opera lovers consider Baroque opera to be of the da capo aria kind, where you have set piece numbers with the recitative in between. Well, that's not the case in this piece or in the Purcell. There aren't so much as set piece numbers as continuous musical texture of chorus, dance and air, you might call them. And the style of the air is also like recitative, and it shares this in a way with earlier Italian opera, in that you can't really tell the difference between an aria and a recitative. They're one and the same thing. They're all sung. And it's the language that really that dictates how music is written. Now, that sounds like a statement of the obvious, but for people in the Baroque, both in France, England, and the Italian traditions, composers were concerned about the rhetorical declamation, and of course music was almost considered a branch of rhetoric, or at least composers were expected to be able to set the text in a way that was totally related to training in rhetoric. So the setting of the English language in both pieces is particular and very interesting, and it seems a shame that Blow did not write more work for the stage, because this piece is, of course, the most well-known English operatic work of its time, besides Dido, and they're both really the first English operas. Now, in terms of genre, you can argue that Venus and Adonis is not an opera per se, but that's kind of a moot point. There are works for the stage that are sung from beginning to end, so by our understanding, we would certainly call them operas, even though they are certainly derived, they're syntheses of other theatrical and operatic traditions.
Are you going to be performing and conducting from the harpsichord, and are you having special Baroque style or early instruments?
We are having a specialist period band. The Purcell is scored for four-part strings and continuo, so we will have a very small specialised group of players. The Blow is similar, except it also calls for two recorders, and the recorders play sometimes alone and sometimes together, and also in obbligato with the singers. Obbligato means they're playing an independent part while the singers are singing their part. And the recorders in the Blow piece really, in a way, provide a kind of sonic allusion to the sensuality between Venus and Adonis. So we will have specialist players, mostly from, actually coming down from Minneapolis. And I think for those who haven't experienced this before, it's always a shock and a surprise to hear how vivid and colourful and theatrical these old instruments are. Now, you can play Baroque music on modern violins, but the gut strings and the kind of schooling and training and study that these particular players have, they bring a level of informed playing that is a little bit different from some people who solely play modern violin. And they're just as much part of the theatrical experience as the lighting and the scenery and the costume. So I plan to lead from the keyboard. And of course, you would never have a conductor of these pieces. Historically, no one stood up and waved their arms around when these pieces were originally performed. It's not necessary. We have a small band, and it's really chamber music all the way. And the great thing about it is that because the instruments have a pretty wide range and certainly can play very quietly, we also have several kinds of instruments with at least two theorbos, maybe a lute or two. So the continuo group, I suppose you could call it the rhythm section, they support the recitative style declamation in a very particular way. It's not written down. You have to make up. You have to make decisions. And the kind of decisions are based entirely on what's happening on stage. So it's a collaboration. It's not a dictatorship. It's making it a unique performance. And the dynamic range, of course, is wide in the sense that you can do it very quietly. So you can have moments of extraordinary musical intimacy that you don't have in bigger or louder opera. It's very healthy music to sing. You can't hurt yourself singing this music. It has actually, I'd say, a wider colour palette. So, of course, some of it is already there just in its harmonic progressions and its dissonance and resolution that suggests longing or then satisfaction or whatever.
Simpson College Opera Chair and Music Coach Dr. Bernard MacDonald. Dr. MacDonald comments on Purcell's well-known tender conclusion to Dido and Aeneas.
When I am laid in earth, Dido's famous lament, it's one of the most famous extracts of all opera, certainly in English, and it's an exemplar of the ground bass technique, whereby you have a repeated bass line over and over and over again, over which a vocal line is laid along with some other instrumental voices. And this technique is also used in The Blow in Venus and Adonis. And the lament, the particular kind of ground bass that's used, it's a descending tetrachord. And this descending bass line is a musical emblem of mourning. And it's not just in this English opera, but we also find this in the Italian Baroque. It's a signifier. So having this constantly repeated bass line, but with some kind of variation above, is in some ways a time-tested way to structure music. And I have a very wonderful guest stage director, Crystal Manich, and we have a guest designer who has collaborated with Crystal before, Lindsay Coda. And together they have been trying to come up with a way to tell these timeless stories in a way that resonates with the student body. And at the moment it's looking like we will set it somehow in a mid-20th century setting, or maybe World War II era setting, without being too overtly specific. So our aim is to provide a completely authentic storytelling, but in a setting that probably speaks to our students and our audience in a quite a direct way. I think the combination of this historically informed musical performance with a kind of modern take on the staging will provide a pretty strong storytelling. To me, it seems that these characters, although they're mythological, or in the case of Venus and Adonis, they're very real characters. So making it real for the audience is important. The performers having an understanding that they have to perform like their characters are going through these real life situations is important. So that's certainly part of the consideration as far as design and direction go, and it's a privilege for all of us to be involved in an endeavour like this.
Assistant Professor of Music, Larson Chair of Opera, Dewey and Larson Chair in Opera at Simpson College, and Music Coach Dr. Bernard MacDonald. Simpson College Opera's Fall Double Bill, complete with early music players, will showcase Venus and Adonis by John Blow and Dido and Aeneas by Henry Purcell. Musical direction will be by Bernard MacDonald and stage direction by Crystal Manich. Performances will be held on Friday and Saturday evenings, October 7th and 8th at 7:30, along with a Sunday afternoon matinee on October 9th at 2. For tickets, go to events.simpson.edu. For synopsis and production details, go to simpson.edu/music/opera. Today's September and early October Iowa Arts Showcase broadcast is a production of Iowa Public Radio. Program thanks for this show goes to Connie Swoboda, Maestro Mark Russell Smith, Bradford Tice, Sarah Chang, and Bernard MacDonald. Production thanks goes to Iowa Public Radio's Tony Daner. I'm Jacqueline Hallblum. Thanks for joining us. For more information on Iowa Public Radio's programming schedule and Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Arts Showcase, please visit our website at iowapublicradio.org.